Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Professor Chris Alden, Director of LSE Ideas. LSE Ideas is a foreign policy think tank based at the LSE and linked to the IR Department and the International History Department. Amongst the many projects that we have is a new initiative on digital IR. We're looking at digital IR in the information age. And the aim of this project, in short, is to identify trends and developments in the world of technology, examine their implications for international relations, and reflect upon those over the longer haul. We've got a set of primers, a set of events, and new research as part of the byproducts of what we are putting together here. And we urge you to do, when you get a chance, take a look at our website, LSE Ideas Digital IR. We are very pleased to have Kaya Siglich with us today, who is going to help us launch this project formally into the public domain. Kaya is a senior director of the Digital Diplomacy Division at Microsoft Corporation. She leads Microsoft's work on digital peace, focusing on encouraging international peace and stability online. Previously, she worked in the company's International Cybersecurity Policy Network. Before joining Microsoft, Kaya worked at the APCO, APCO Worldwide Technology Practice in Seattle, and worked as a director at APCO Worldwide Brussels office as well. She holds a BSc in International Relations and History and an MSc in European Politics. I'm very pleased and proud that that's from the LSE, in fact. So it's welcome back, even if it's a cyber form of that. Over to you, Kaya.
Thank you. I'm going to share my slides and hopefully you can see them. Thank you. And it's great to be back. I think being at LSE, both for my undergrad and postgrad, was lots of fun. So anything I can do to come back, even virtually, though hopefully at some point soon we can all travel again. So that would be good as well. So thank you for inviting me. I'm very excited about helping launch this project. And I will talk a little bit today, whilst not distracted by the dog, about the importance of diplomacy effectively in cyberspace today. And we'll talk a little bit about Microsoft, what Microsoft is seeing in this area, what are some of the latest trends that we have observing, as well as what's going on in the geopolitical sphere. I will also talk a little bit about some of the initiatives that we have been pushing as a company, hopefully to advance peace and stability online, and then leave a fair amount of time at the end to have a conversation, hopefully with you all. So get ready to ask any questions. To start with, the cyberspace today. And I think cyberspace is changing every day. I think what we have seen over the past 2 years has been a dramatic shift all of us, you know, working, conferencing, speaking to friends and family online. So the shift that has already been ongoing in terms of greater digitalization has only accelerated. That has meant that both increasing the number of people are online, many people in emerging economies in particular are only now coming online and coming online in millions. We had a map a few years back that had little bubbles in terms of how many people are online in each part of the world and sort of as proportion of the population. And looking at countries in Africa in particular, Nigeria, South Africa, but then also countries like Indonesia, those are massive populations and populations are increasing. So the shift will, over the next few years, most definitely go from the West, where we had the biggest bubbles for the longest time, to more emerging economies, and not just the usual suspects that we often think, China and India, but other countries around the world as well. At the same time, we are also seeing a greater number of devices online. Whether you're thinking about phones, whether you're thinking about speakers, whether you're thinking about devices in factories, again, the numbers are growing day by day. And that means that the cyber attack surface is also growing. So the area that, whether it's criminals, whether it's nation states, whether it's a combination of both actors that can go after, whether it's for money, whether it's for espionage, whether it's for some other purpose, is growing day by day. So even if we continuously increase investments in cybersecurity, and as we become more aware as individuals in terms of what we should be doing to be safer online, because the potential scope, the potential pie is growing, the attacks are growing day by day, and their impact is growing day by day. States are responding to this in different ways. First of all, they are acting as defenders, effectively. So, as their role in national security, as domestic legislator, they're investing in whether it's legislative initiatives or on protecting critical infrastructures, or in just capabilities in terms of defense. So creating national cybersecurity agencies, creating offices where they can talk to each other, recognizing that this is an area that really requires international cooperation, as well as, increasingly, which, is also why we at Microsoft have a digital diplomacy team, investing in sort of cyber as part of foreign policy. And this is where you see the companies now increasingly starting to talk to foreign offices, ministers of foreign affairs, on some of these issues. Then at the same time, they're also investing in offensive technologies. So the number 60 up there is a number a few years old, that I think it was Washington, was the Wall Street Journal that sort of went through the list of potential of the states that have either potential or declared military offensive strategies, but the number is going up day by day almost. The attacks, the nation state attacks, are similarly increasing. The slide is just sort of a highlight of some of the most prominent attacks that have received attention over the past decade or so. Stuxnet is probably still the most famous one. This is the attack on the Iranian nuclear power plants back in 2009, I feel. Is widely thought about as being a nation state attack, although it has never been attributed. The attacks that are sort of in the next few years that follow tend to be such as Saudi Aramco, are similarly widely assumed to be a retribution from the Iranians to sort of the Western allies of the states that potentially have attacked them the first time around. And so at the beginning, we've seen sort of highly sophisticated, highly targeted attacks, but there's not really been much pushback in those early periods in terms of, and there's not really been a great understanding of what is allowed or not allowed in terms of nation state activity in cyberspace. Because there's been no pushback to at least according to me, states have increasingly pushed the boundaries of what they could do in cyberspace. So as you see, as sort of the years go on, the activity becomes much more, it grows. And so the Sony attacks, in 2014, the OPM is the Office of Personnel Management in the US, where a lot of data, personal data, obviously, was stolen or accessed. The Japan Pension Service, similar attack going after personal data of government officials, I think, show an expansion of activity. And then with the 2016, we see a greater focus on elections, both in terms of cyber attacks, but also in terms of we start seeing more of a sort of disinformation campaign element enter this equation, more often than not to the two together. So there's a, you know, in the US, you'd see the hack on the Podesta email and then sort of a leak of some of the information that was hacked from the as part of a broader disinformation campaign. Then 2017, 2018, the sort of the NotPetya WannaCry attacks were really, really large attacks that I think like impacted the globe, and particularly in the UK, the impact on the National Health Service, I think, was notable, predominantly because the two attacks showed that the how connected we are, because even though potentially they were targeted a particular country, they spread around the world incredibly quickly. And sort of we see this this kind of escalate to greater number of attacks, and particularly on whether it's vaccine research, whether it's on the WHO during the COVID pandemic, largely to try and get information. And then just about a year and a bit ago, I think one of the most prominent attacks was the SolarWinds attack in the US again, using the software supply chain update mechanism, which from a private sector's perspective is particularly scary because the software update mechanism is the only thing we have to fix the problems that we have. So if the trust in that mechanism is undermined, and it is potentially already quite low, I think that really, really damages the stability of the online environment. And of course, the last couple of weeks, we've seen a substantial number of attacks in Ukraine, as geopolitical tensions in that area kind of grow, spin out of control. I think cyber is increasingly also an area that is being used as a tool that's being used to advance a particular country's goals. This I'm just going to highlight so you can go and look at it afterwards if you are very keen. A lot of the information that I'm going to talk about comes from the Microsoft Digital Defense Report. Just put it into a search engine of your choice. Effectively, the data, it comes from what we're seeing on our systems. So it is a particular view of the world. This is the Microsoft view of the world, as we do not necessarily see what Google sees or what Facebook sees or what country sees. We have a particular view that focuses very squarely on individuals, organizations that use Microsoft products and services, particularly those in the cloud. But as you can see from the numbers on the slides, the number of what we see is still significantly quite high. So hopefully it has a fair amount of relevance to what is actually going on. In terms of the nation states that we are tracking, specifically through a dedicated threat intel team. So a little bit which is interesting, a lot of the intelligence and sort of foreign service departments have a threat intelligence part. And so we recently also established a dedicated team that tracks nation state attacks with experts that basically have a desk, a Russia desk, a China desk, a North Korea desk, that sort of kind of wed the technical knowledge and what you're actually seeing on the systems with geopolitical understanding and what's going on, you know, whether it's providing insights into what's going on with Ukraine currently, whether, you know, giving understanding to our technical teams that in a particular period in time, there is the Iran nuclear deal negotiations going on. So something might happen around that. Sort of trying to merge those two different, very, very different disciplines and gain insights and into those. So the countries that we track, or not countries necessarily, the actors that we track that we think are nation state actors. And we have given them names from the periodic system. So there's no common nomenclature across the industry and also across governments in terms of how the different actors are called. So, you know, there's the cozy bears and those type of names, but we've decided that the periodic system seems to work well. So here you see sort of the names, and the groups that we have seen as active. And, you know, the numbers, like I said earlier, the numbers of countries are increasing. This year, in the report, we've added Turkey as the first NATO member, we have actively seen go after our customers, as well as Vietnam. But the most active continue to be Russia, North Korea, and China. I think for North Korea is also fairly interesting to recognize that they are one of the actors that go, even the actors associated with governments are one of the actors that go after money. As the vast majority of nation state attacks have a basically still an espionage aim in mind, which is why you also see on this slide, you know, the think tanks, the academia, as well as obviously governments are the most targeted groups because people are after information. But North Korea, because the sanctions have made such an impact on the government, means that a lot of the government sectors are not funded, including the cyber part. So they need to self-fund. So that basically means that as part of their operations, they also go after money. And I think there was, I'm now going to forget the numbers, I'm not going to say it, but I think there was an article earlier this week, there was a few articles earlier this week, the UN came out with an estimate, I'm going to say it was probably $400 million, but again, I'm not sure if I remember correctly. It was a large number of how much money the North Korean nation state, as the actors associated with North Korea brought into the country over the past year. Here in terms of the states that we see are as the most targeted, I would also just keep in mind that the vast majority of the information we can see and we can gather is from the cloud environment, so not necessarily on premise. So this also skews the data a little bit. So the US is very high just because they've moved to cloud much earlier than some of the other countries, but it's probably still fairly accurate. With that quick like overview of what we're seeing, I also wanted to talk a little bit about what can be, should be done around all of these areas. I mean, this slide kind of explains why Microsoft is engaged in this space. We think this is a shared responsibility. You know, as industry, we need to invest in the security of our products and services, but also it means that unlike other domains, we own and operate the vast majority of what is being attacked at the moment in cyberspace. And that means that we know and understand how to fix some of these issues and can point to what attacks could be particularly problematic. I mentioned the supply chain attack earlier at the beginning, but there's others in this space. And this is why Microsoft, now for over a decade, has been talking, engaging in international discussion in this area. In the international discussions, so the UN, again, about 10 years, a little bit more, have been discussing the questions of nation state cyber attacks in groups that are called the Group of Governmental Experts, the GGEs, with some success and with some not so much, depending on the year. Last year was surprisingly a fairly successful outcome. There were two discussions that were ongoing, the GGE, but also an open-ended working group on cybersecurity, both as part of the disarmament committee in the UN, one sponsored by the Russians, but one sponsored by the Americans. And they both published two reports. Both the reports were in alignment and underlined some very fundamental principles, such as international law needs to apply in cyberspace, and that includes international humanitarian law, it includes human rights law, and sort of the UN Charter in its entirety. They reaffirmed a GGE report from 2015, which effectively committed states to a set of 11 non-binding norms. Those over time, as states again and again reaffirmed to them, hopefully they have become a little bit more binding, that touch upon, they're not hard law, but help augment it. So things like states should not attack critical infrastructures, but also states should protect critical infrastructures. States should cooperate in sort of helping each other when they're attacked, and sort of this 11 kind of rules that kind of go down the line. And Microsoft has been pushing and advocating for these, like, throughout this period, including, I think, probably most notably in 2017, when we called for what we refer to as the Digital Geneva Convention. So recognizing this is something that will take a long time and it's difficult to achieve in our current geopolitical environment, but also recognizing that there is an important need to push states to recognize that they need to have some rules of restraint that they can adhere to as the online environment connects us all increasingly. And we've seen over the past year how important some of these rules would have been, as particularly with ransomware over the past couple of years, effectively blocks hospitals completely, blocks governments or local governments from operating. So the impact is real, and not just sort of a theoretical framework, which I think 5 years ago when we first talked about it kind of was. We've also endorsed a French-led initiative, Paris Call for Trust and Security in Cyberspace, a set of principles for both governments, industry, and civil society to increase, again, peace and security online, as well as funded a nonprofit, Cyber Peace Institute, and sort of pushed and advocated for greater understanding of how international law applies in cyberspace. I'm not going to go through all of these examples. I feel most of these have websites, but we've tried to not only just use our voice and build alliances with like-minded governments, but also encouraged to raise awareness of some of these issues. I think the last 6 months, it's been in the news, cyber warfare has been in the news a lot, but even a year ago, you know, it was hard to break through the media landscape and try to ensure that people understand how important some of these issues are. So that bringing in nonprofits, bringing in civil society, academia, as well as others in the industry has really been a priority for us. Then I will kind of stop here. I think hopefully there are questions for discussion. I think the things that, as you know, as a follow-up to the conversation, I would love for you to all think about is, we think the current trends are and situations is untenable. The number of attacks is just increasing. Despite the efforts, despite the incremental progress. So figuring out how we can, as a global community, do something to actually encourage restraint, I think will be really important. I think the as it was in previous eras, to, I'm not saying cyber is a weapon of mass destruction, it's not, it's very different, but the impacts can be significant, and sort of understanding how we together are able to ensure stability online will be very important. Secondly, states need to uphold international law and implement norms. There's been a lot of commitments to doing so, but it's vast majority of countries have stayed at the commitment level. I will also say I think it's important to increase capacity across the board. A lot of the countries just don't know how to, they don't have the resources, how to implement, how do you implement a norm on critical infrastructure protection online if you have two or three people in the whole country in the government working on cybersecurity. In under building those capacities, I think will be really important. And as our president, Brad Smith, the guy who won the picture earlier, says frequently, states have a responsibility as a private sector, but states also have a responsibility to regulate us. So that's another area that we need to figure out, not just as big companies, but understanding how we can increase cybersecurity across the ecosystem, whether it's small and medium-sized businesses or any company today. Increasingly has code in their, whether it's a car company, whether it's a bank, and they have their own code to develop and they need to develop security. So spreading awareness and understanding of those practices, I think, will also be incredibly important. The third point is that there are gaps. I've talked about healthcare, I've touched upon healthcare. At the moment, at times of war, not in the kinetic environment, you're not allowed to bomb a hospital, but somehow you're allowed to achieve the same effect online. So that cannot stand in reality, and there are a lot of examples like that in cyber. And then finally, we think in the multi-stakeholder way is the only way forward. I think there needs to be a debate between the private sector, between governments, between civil society and academia, to find a path forward. There need to be regular consultations on domestic and international levels. Otherwise, I think we just won't make any progress. But with that, I will open up for debate.
Thank you very much. Really fascinating. It gives us a great starting point to think about both the big picture and some of the finer points of and particulars of this. We have quite a number of questions coming through. So let me start with Moon Sulfa. And Moon has thanked you for the presentation. And if I can paraphrase, the world has witnessed an uptick in cybersecurity incidents that have targeted critical infrastructure for political objectives. And with the current geopolitical tensions between the US, Russia, and China, isn't it safe to assume that the notion of cyber norms is no longer achievable and that it's time for a recognized international cyber treaty? So I know you were speaking towards those things, but I thought perhaps you can elaborate on that.
I think, yeah, thank you. No, I think the challenge is the same, right? I think the treaties are equally difficult to achieve as are norms when it comes to geopolitics. At the end of the day, you need to negotiate them, and then you need to uphold the terms that have been agreed and drive accountability for it. I think in the current environment, it's very difficult to achieve either. But, you know, we've seen over the past year, as I mentioned, the UN processes were able to come to an agreement. The agreements were, you know, progress was very incremental. And some of this, I will also say, is just diplomacy. You know, this is a new field. And I think they've been talking about this for about 10 years, which, you know, if you think about how long it took for like maritime or space or any of these areas of law to emerge, the diplomats think that they're probably making lightning progress. It's just that technology moves faster. So I think the question is not, I think, either, it's not necessarily an either or. I think we probably need both. I think the question is at what time we are able to negotiate. This is the bit where I get very negative, I feel, which is, you know, we've seen in the past on many other issues that what you need is a sort of a big external event that kind of shakes countries up a little bit and motivates them into a set of things where they're able to make compromises and agree. And I think that we might at some point need this on cyber. I think at the moment, you know, there are several states that have vast resources and you know, across the board. I think I wouldn't necessarily say, you know, this is something that the West doesn't do or the East doesn't do. To go very Cold War, but I think, and so it's not necessarily in their interest that they to sort of negotiate a set of issues that would effectively restrain their operations. At the same time, I do think there are things like, you know, the global financial system, or that if it was actively undermined online, all countries would suffer. So I'm sure there are areas where I think we can make progress. But I think at the moment it's kind of like making those small steps forward.
And there are quite a number of other questions as well, but if I could jump in for a minute and ask you on the point of diplomacy, do you think that certainly cyberspace is a distinctive sphere? It has material content and it has the somewhat immaterial form. Does diplomacy, digital diplomacy, does it differ in some way, or is it really just the kind of diplomacy we saw? You've made reference to previous, you know, just a moment ago, to diplomatic practices, multilateral, multi-stakeholder practices. Will it be different to pull this together?
So I think largely no. At the same time, I think where the difference is, I think it is the, like I said earlier, I think it is the the importance of the private sector in this area as the operators of the vast majority of these technologies. And the fact that in previous eras you have weapons are live an army basis, but today it could be just on your phone, right? So the fact that the vulnerabilities are everywhere, I think it does mean that there is a much greater involvement, not just for the industry, but I think also civil society and sort of understanding the day-to-day impacts that some of these technologies could have on people. I think that's where it differs. And I think that's where the discussions need to change meaningfully from just particularly because these are now issues of national security focused, just closed door discussions, to actually bringing in other participants that are able to share the both in terms of the impact on, like I said, individuals, but also the what is going on and sort of how some of these technologies interconnect with each other, because I think that's not necessarily always clear to everybody. But otherwise, I think it is a very similar practice that a lot of the other ones have been in the past. I will also say I think states are starting to recognize that there needs to be a bigger tent. They themselves are starting to appoint cyber ambassadors. I think a lot of countries, I think maybe Denmark was the first one, but I think others have followed suit. I think the US just recently, there was an article yesterday, sort of, they still don't have a person, but started building a cyber bureau. There's a lot of countries that, the cyber ambassador could be a post that is appointed to effectively the Silicon Valley, but also oftentimes is a roaming ambassador that sits in the nation state, so in the capital, but then sort of has a focus solely on the cyber processes, and not just the sort of norms, but other discussions that are going on, whether it's on disinformation, on hybrid threats, on cyber crime, as a treaty is being negotiated there as well. So and also have part of their role to engage with the broader multi-stakeholder community. So I think we're slowly getting there, but very slowly.
So our diplomats aren't out of business, in fact. No. Just retooling in some way. Yeah. Okay, we have David Webster, Global Tech Connect. He's talking about Lloyd's insurance brokers recently announced that the cyber insurance will no longer cover attacks by nation states. This has huge implications, and attribution is now worth a lot of money. Do you think that Lloyd's new policy is a good development? Is it viable? In fact, I would add.
So I think I have not necessarily read the all of the things that have happened in great detail. But the court decisions that came down as part of the NotPetya actions, that so 2017, it took until I guess early or in January for some of the there were a few insurance firms that were sued for not paying out because it was allegedly a nation state attack. It was a nation state attack. So the exclusion applied. I think in between, a lot of the definitions changed a little bit. The insurance policies have shifted. So there are still, and again, like I've not followed this in super a lot of detail, but my understanding is there were still there are still cyber war exclusions. They are maybe narrower, but there's not been a dramatic shift just because of those decisions. In terms of what it means, I think it is problematic when, particularly when states do increasingly act and in this area. So it, you know, insurance is an important risk management tool in cyber, so it is important. But it's not, it doesn't necessarily, I think, shift the debate dramatically. I would say in terms of attribution, I think that is an area that clearly needs more work, I would say. You know, we've seen, hopefully it's something that has moved in a positive direction over the past couple of years, where, you know, 5 years ago, very rarely we have seen like states come out and say, this country did this, it is a bad thing. We now increasingly see this occur, and we see increasingly states coordinate attribution activities, which is also good because it inspires greater confidence when, you know, 20 countries do it versus where just one country does it. And we think it's an important element of upholding norms, upholding international law, to actually be like, guys, what you did is wrong, and it's wrong for this reason. Please don't do it again and impose sanctions. But then we also increasingly see the private sector do it. Again, we don't necessarily assign it to particular states. Like you saw on the slides, you know, we assign it to a particular actor that comes from a particular state. We make assumptions about whether they're actually acting on behalf of the states, because this is where we don't necessarily see the from the technical data, you know, who is giving the orders. We just see it's coming from this territory.
I suppose in some ways it's sort of attribution of who fired the first shot sort of thing, where you see a crowd and of armed people, and you make assumption that there was an authorization there, may not be, but it's treated as such eventually. There's a question here, quite a number of questions, but a question here about public-private partnerships and cybersecurity. If there are any examples, and if you could cite them, and if there are.
No, I think there's several. I think I'll maybe give one in terms of the work that we do, that I work on, which is more in terms of, you know, how we work together around the international processes. And the example I would give is, it's an initiative called Let's Talk Cyber. And I mean, it's actually multi-stakeholders, is a little more than just public-private. But the idea behind it is to, you know, it brings together the Canadian government, the Australian government, a few nonprofits, and us as well. And the idea behind it is to create a venue for conversations and consultations around the United Nations processes on cyber. And partly because the processes themselves have been fairly closed, with you know, few exceptions. I think there's been a push by a certain countries, Russia in particular, to keep out the non-state actors and just have the discussions focused on just state to state. So the ability to actually engage regularly through this framework and have conversations and help sort of shape the debate has been very useful. I think, and then there's others on the more technical side. A number of countries have public-private partnerships that focus on information sharing. So they bring together maybe in a particular sector and share the latest threat intelligence, government to industry and vice versa. So they're able to react more speedily to what's going on.
Great, thanks. Another question. This one is from a former intelligence analyst for transnational organized crime in the ex-Soviet states, Ewan Grant. You have mentioned it, but I think he wants a specific question to you. He says, I don't think there's been a mention of the two Security Council wielding, veto-wielding states, Russia and China. Why not? But you have mentioned, but perhaps to develop that a bit, I think it links also with the question of implications of if attribution has been found. Someone else was asking if attribution is identified to a given country, do we not, does one operate? I think it was Farah Shahabuddin asked this, whether one, you know, still operates as Microsoft in those particular countries, given if there is that attribution of cyber attacks emanating from those countries.
Yeah, no, I think maybe on the Security Council, obviously they're not the only ones that are wielding states. I wouldn't necessarily just point to them. I will say the Security Council has, again, over the past couple of years, I think Estonia was a non-permanent member over the past 2 years, and they've pushed cybersecurity quite a lot on the agenda, not necessarily in the formal sessions, but in as part of the sort of awareness raising conversations on particular issues. I think healthcare was one of the topics that was discussed. But they've not necessarily like condemned anyone or acted on it. I think partly because the fact that obviously it's Security Council is in the most geopolitical thing that you can have. It's probably the definition, but also the vast majority of the attacks that we see, and a lot of them that the vast majority, I think probably, I'm just trying to think whether there was one of them that I've actually mentioned that there wouldn't be, but the majority, so I think all of them have happened under the threshold of war. So I think that's a thing to remember in cyber, whereas in the past conflicts, you have a state of war, international humanitarian law applies. What we see today is constant attacks, as constant ongoing probing, planting things, discovery, and without there being loaded in peacetime. Effectively in peacetime. So I think that's the difference to also think about a little bit in terms of where we are. I think there's not really been, there's not been an attack that has gone above that threshold in terms of, there's not been a state that has called out it as an attack, for instance, on a NATO member or something like that. So I think that impacts a lot of the conversations there as well. In terms of where the attacks come from, we are a global company. We basically operate everywhere. Obviously we hope that we get attacked less, but I think it's the reality of today's environment.
Good. We got another question. So the speaker says, appreciate the need to shift to multi-stakeholder models with more private sector engagement. Will this create an imbalance as small companies or startups or, I've just lost the very question. will this create an imbalance between, having trouble with my chat here, side of things. Yeah.
I see the question.
Oh, okay.
I will. Will this create an imbalance as smaller companies or startups may face a barrier engaging with longer international, highly technical negotiations and consultation?
Yes.
How can national governments incentivize or support the companies to engage? I think that's a very fair question. And I think, you know, from our perspective, you know, even if you look at the number of even if you look at the nonprofits, you know, it's difficult to follow the international processes. It's difficult, particularly if they're, you know, I think maybe the last couple of years have been a little bit easier because a lot of things have been webcasts, but if they are just sort of, you need to go to New York or Geneva to follow the negotiations, you know, they're cost prohibitive also for both the, you know, both the industry, particularly the smaller ones, and the civil society and academia. So I think there is, you know, there are definitely things that, and also they're difficult to understand because they are very, you know, very specific processes that if you do not follow and you kind of come from the sort of private sector background where it's the, like I said, like I think referenced earlier, the speed is the expectation of how quickly things move is very different from the sort of, oh, it might take 10 years plus to go to get to a treaty. I think that will be, I think, difficult. So I think from our perspective, we've attempted to bring trade associations on board as well. So the, you know, things like International Chamber of Commerce have been participating, following, and sort of hopefully sharing the information back out to their sort of domestic chapters. On the industry perspective, the Cybersecurity Tech Accord has been like a group of 150, both small and large companies that have been really engaging and active in it. But there's other things for sure that states can do domestically. I think I'll give an example on the cybercrime treaty negotiations because it's sort of adjacent, but very similar in terms of the process. It was supposed to start, the negotiations were supposed to start about 2 weeks ago, but they were postponed because of COVID. But a number of countries ahead of time have held national consultations. And just in terms of trying to understand what their positions should be and what their industry, their civil society would like the countries to advocate for, and not just big countries. So you know, the UK did it, the US did it, but I'm Slovenian. Slovenia did it too. And you know, there was, I was very positively surprised because there was so much, for the Slovenian one in particular, there was so much interest. There were over sort of, I think there were over 50 participants. Everybody had ideas, suggestions. So I think if states are willing, and again, yes, it's complicated. It adds to the sort of burden of negotiations, but I think there is a thriving community that would love to actually be able to input into the negotiations. So I think consultations are the best way forward. Ultimately states still decide and they are the ones in the negotiation process and they should be, but I think they can gather a lot of input ahead of time.
Great, we're running out of time actually. And we've still got quite a number of questions. So I'm gonna pick one or two and ask you if you can speak to these fairly shortly. One question here is, to what extent do you consider a cyber weapon the disinformation or propaganda campaigns via social media? Was Cambridge Analytica a cyber actor weaponizing Facebook according to you or not?
So we have typically really focused on the traditional attacks, the attack networks, and I think partly because it's easier, partly this is the focus that has been on the converse in the discussions in the United Nations as well, in terms of you know, how can you track and limit some of these attacks. Obviously, disinformation campaigns, particularly the ones that are sponsored and driven by state actors with the objective of effective foreign interference, whatever the objective is, like create distrust, create misunderstanding, you know, influence elections, whatever it is. I think that these have been areas of state engagement forever. You know, I think whether you look at the Cold War, whether you look at ancient Rome, I think disinformation has always been there. I think the thing that is different is the speed of the how quickly disinformation can share, and the sort of the bubbles that we experience. But it's not necessarily something that I would say is dramatically new. But like I said, so we've traditionally focused much more on the actual impacts on infrastructure, but that does not mean that the disinformation campaigns, I'm sorry, don't have a dramatic effect on you know, our society today, because they clearly do.
Great. I think time for one last question, and then this is the emerging cyber diplomacy phenomena has appeared as a way to mitigate cyber attacks and regulate cyberspace. To what extent do you think cyber diplomacy, this thing jumps every time I'm in the middle of this, something else comes in. Think cyber diplomacy shares features with traditional diplomacy, given the radical differences in time, machine time, human time, and space?
So I think the speed is important here, but diplomacy is critical for building relationships and for, you know, things like confidence building measures, again, which are a tool of diplomacy that's been around for 70, 80 plus years, probably more. They are equally critical today. So from that perspective, I think that there's not much has changed, right? I think in terms of when something happened, being able to reach out to your counterpart and to have a conversation and sort of build, you know, and hopefully understand whether something that you are seeing is, you have a conversation about whether something you're seeing is a threat, or it's an offensive posture, it's a defensive posture, or it's just a misunderstanding. I think in situations like these, diplomacy plays a critical role, also plays a critical role when building the relationships of trust. So I think it's very much here to stay.
Great, thanks. It's a great note to leave on. Thank you again, Kaya, for a tour de force, covering all this ground and fielding many a question as well. I'm so pleased that you were able to share this time with us and to help us open up the topic and digital diplomacy more generally. And thanks again to our attendees. I'm sorry that we didn't get to every question. There will be other opportunities to come around and digitally and possibly, as Kaya was saying, in person in future. So thank you again, and have a good afternoon. See you soon. Bye.
Thank you.